Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote and rather damp jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and this is Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Big hello to everybody. We've had rather warm weather. Big storm ran through central Indiana, so I've been told by several of the people involved technically with the program, if all of a sudden something happens tonight, we'll understand why. Taking over the technical production job this week, our good friend from Dayton, Ohio, Wayne Larson, will be doing that. He'll be monitoring the chat room and any calls that may come in. And also, as always, Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson.
So you have no power tonight, I'm told.
Tonight, I am in the dark.
Well, it's been like that for
Well, yeah, that goes without saying, but yes.
So you may have to leave us early. We completely understand, but we appreciate your expertise with the Wild World News, and we'll have it.
Well, it just depends on how long the lights hold out here, so we'll do as good as we can.
Coming along just a little bit, we have with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Jim Willis, Deputy Director of the National Conservation Training Center. Just got back from Louisiana, had a chance to look, well, I'd say firsthand at the Gulf leak. And, of course, the good news tonight, they have that sucker capped, so that's fantastic news. Historical moment for the natural world here in the United States, and I know there's a lot of, oh, my Lord, there's lots of folks down in that part of the country that are quite happy, well, all across the country, because this has been a natural disaster, but, gosh, it looks like maybe they've got this thing stopped, and then the real work sets in of trying to clean up that mess. We want to remind everybody that tonight's Larry Batson's Wild World News is underwritten by Jet Kaiser Films. If you have a corporation, a company that's getting ready to put together a documentary or some type of film production, all HD, Jet Kaiser Films. Here's their website, jetkaiser.com, and he will go around the world to make your film needs come true. So that's Jet Kaiser, and he's been kind enough to underwrite our Wild World News, brought to you by Dr. Henry Day. Go ahead, Doc.
All right, let's get on with it. We're starting out tonight in North Bonneville, Washington. Bali just said that the numbers of salmon and steelhead heading up the Columbia River are well above average, including a record run of sockeye. The Chinook this year, 140% above average, the 10-year average, while the sockeye run more than 353,000 fish is a record. The sockeye and the salmon are running record numbers this year.
Well, that means the bears will be fat and happy.
That might mean
instead of having twins, some of the bears may have triplets.
Oh, that's just what we need.
Well, that's...
Because I don't know about you, but I love salmon.
Well, I do too. I absolutely do. So good for the salmon and good for that part of the country.
Ashland, Oregon. Wildlife has become a little too wild there, as dozens of deer are running through the city. Several have attacked people who are walking their dogs, and one recently crashed through a window of Nimbus, a high-end clothing store downtown.
Where is this?
Written on the window plywood patch was, "Oh, dear."
That's pretty witty.
Boy,
where was this at now? I'm sorry. Where did this happen at?
Oh, we're in Ashland, Oregon.
Oh, okay. Well, that's too bad. Now they haven't figured out why the deer have gone rampant.
I don't know. Maybe because the salmon are above population.
Yeah,
you never know. All right. Orleans, Massachusetts. 15-foot white shark has been spotted just south of Nassau Beach on Cape Cod. Chatham Harbor master Stuart Smith said a spotter plane saw a shark Sunday chasing seals into the breaking surf. A spokeswoman for the Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs said there is no need to avoid the beach, but people should avoid swimming near the seals.
Well, that's probably a good idea.
I guess that kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. Well, and you know, the remember the film Jaws? The inspiration for the film Jaws was a shark fisherman by the name of Frank Mundus, and he was based out of off the coast of New York, and they'd go fishing right off the coast of New York for some world record great white sharks. So, that whole area.
And what were they using for bait? Seals?
I don't know. We're using.
All right. Well, let's run off to Medina, Ohio. Now listen to this.
Medina, story. By the way.
Medina. Okay. Well, I'm from Kansas, so we got Molina and Malina.
That's right.
Okay. A truck crash left animal carcasses all over a country road, and the driver's pet monkey stranded atop a utility pole.
The driver's pet monkey.
The State Highway Patrol said the frightened monkey scampered up the pole after the truck carrying carcasses from a meat processing plant flipped over while going into a curve. The driver wasn't hurt, but the monkey had to be coaxed down.
I'll bet.
I guess you flip a truck, you know, with a bunch of dead animals.
Yeah, the monkey's running for his life.
Yeah, I wish I knew what kind of monkey it was. It'd make it a little more interesting.
Whatever you say.
Westbrook, Connecticut. The state has issued a public plea to beachgoers to beware of the vulnerable birds such as the piping plovers, herons, and egrets that nest near the parks and the islands. Environment officials said the beachgoers can accidentally trample their nests.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Island on in Milford and Duck Island in Westbrook are already closed, you know, due to the nesting.
Well, that's
through September 15th.
Well, it should be. That's a good idea.
Yep, I agree.
Absolutely.
Kalispell, Montana. State officials are bolstering effects to prevent invasive aquatic species from entering waterways by adding more boat checkpoints and reminders to boaters to examine and clean watercraft. The State Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and the Department of Agriculture hope to keep the species of the zebra mussels and the Eurasian milfoid, which can damage the ecosystems.
Yeah, absolutely. The zebra mussels is a big problem. You know, Lake Erie.
They're everywhere now. They've
yeah.
been people moving, transporting. They're just
yep.
getting out of hand.
That's
all right. Reno, Nevada. Activists saved 172 wild horses with help from the wife of oil tycoon T. Boone Pickens and others. The horses, believed to be strays or abandoned, were likely headed for slaughter, but the Lifesavers Wild Horse Rescue Group bought them for $31,000.
Oh, good for them.
Now, see, if you're going to use your money for something, there you go.
That's right. Or you
Naples, Florida. Wildlife officials are advising people to stay out of the freshwater canals and lakes after an alligator bit off a teen's arm Sunday.
Mm.
Timothy Delano, 18, was swimming with friends in a Collier County canal when a 10-foot alligator attacked. A Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission spokeswoman said the hand was retrieved from the alligator's stomach.
Oh, well, that's nice. You know, it's pretty amazing, though. There's over a million alligators. In fact, everything that has water in it basically has an alligator living in it, Florida. And no more problems that do happen. I mean, it's still pretty amazing. You know, and those suckers are almost extinct at one time. That's even more incredible.
No kidding. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Douglas, Wyoming. The U.S. Forest Service said it plans to trap and release black-tailed prairie dogs on the Thunder Basin National Grassland later this month through August. Prairie dogs burrow and tear up the landscape, and they want them out of there, even though they are kind of cute. But a lot of the people, the equestrians, the horse riders, those prairie dog holes are perfect for a horse to step in, break an ankle, and where do you go from there?
You don't want my opinion on this, do you?
No.
No, because I'll go off on it.
Yeah, well.
Too darn bad.
Yeah.
Being in places to ride horses, prairie dogs, it's limited where they can exist, so.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I'm not going to say any more about that.
Okay, the final story of the night. Now, this is a good one.
Okay.
Tortoise returns after four-year jaunt. A 25-pound pet tortoise has reappeared 4 years after escaping from its pen. A New Hampshire couple said that Lucy, an African spur thigh tortoise, disappeared from Mike and Christine Wellington's greenhouse business in Brentwood, New Hampshire. The Wellingtons received a call Friday from a neighbor half a mile away that said that Lucy had showed up at their house begging for food. Wellington said that they are certain it's their Lucy because of the unusual protruding bumps on the tortoise's back. Well, I'm not sure what kind of sense that makes, but I'm glad Lucy's home.
Well, I am too. I read that story, and that's pretty amazing. 2 years, that's incredible. You know, I have a follow-up last week. You know, I did one story for your Animal News in regards to the penguin that was abducted from the Dublin Zoo.
Correct.
And was found later wandering around the streets of Dublin. Well, it seems that the Dublin Zoo has been targeted by annoying pranks before. In 2008, its switchboard was overwhelmed by callers asking to speak to Anaconda, Giraffe.
I think I partied with Anaconda.
I don't know. Well, thanks for the Wild World News. And as we said, it was underwritten by Jet Kaiser Films. Go to Jet Kaiser Films, KAISERfilms.com, and he'll be more than happy to help you out if you've got a documentary in mind or whatever. It's all HD. It's fantastic, so he'll travel around the world. We also want to tell everyone that tonight's program is underwritten by We Want You Cottages way up in western New York, Chautauqua Lake. They have an exciting new website. It's called iKids Fishing, where kids can download their photograph of the big fish that they just caught and compare it to youngsters all across the country. And that website is www.wewanchu.com. And also McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, right on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. If you're going out to Rocky Mountain, and if you've never been there, you've got to go at least once in your life. Spectacular. Here's the website for McGregor Mountain Lodge. Great place to stay. I mean, you're right next to it, folks. You'll have bighorn sheep probably and elk in your backyard. It's incredible. But their website is info@McGregorMountainLodge.com or use that 800 number, 1-800-835-8439. Also, a big thank you to Bass Pro Shops and the Tracker Marine Boating Center way down in Clarksville, Indiana, very close to Louisville, Kentucky. And if you've never been to the Bass Pro Shops, folks, it's an adventure. It's a museum. Well, Dad's checking out the fishing lures and gear. The kids can go check out the aquarium. It's unbelievable. Also, animals from around the world that have been very tastefully mounted. It's a fantastic display, so you want to check that out. The Bass Pro Shops and also the Tracker Marine Boating Center. That didn't sound right. Call Dan White, 812-218-5369. Also, Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina. Lake Marion and Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes, they cover 171,000 acres, 450 miles of shoreline, known for world-class fishing, holds 7 state records and 1 world record, I believe, for a blue catfish that is just humongous. And that website is www.santeecoopercountry.org or call talk.
Do I still have Mr. Willis on the line?
You do.
Okay, somehow we lost our connection with Larry.
I was wondering about that.
We'll just chit-chat a little bit until he comes back. I'm sure he'll realize that he's somehow managed to boot himself.
Okay.
Okay, wait a minute. I think he's back.
I don't know what happened. I'm sorry, everybody. Larry Batson left. I got so excited about going fishing in South Carolina. All of a sudden, beep, gone. I'd like to introduce to everybody. He probably had a chance to talk here for a few moments. He's Deputy Director of the National Conservation Training Center, Jim Willis. It's a fantastic facility. All of your fish and wildlife workers, agents, and so forth, that's their training facility, as well as other conservation groups from all across the country. Jim serves as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Deputies Group and the Interior Training Directors Council. He's also a member of the Governance Board for the National Indian Program Training Center in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Before that, he had a fantastic, unbelievable career in the Coast Guard, which we're going to talk about a little bit. One of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. He's a native of coastal North Carolina, but now lives in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Big welcome to Jim Willis. Good evening, Jim.
Hi, Larry. It's good to be here.
I'm so sorry. I have no idea what happened.
You just disappeared there for a moment.
I disappeared. Have you ever been fishing down in South Carolina?
I have not been fishing in North Carolina.
Well, I'm going to tell you right now, they got these big lakes down there, Jim. They're massive. I mean, it's like you're fishing in the ocean. In fact, we're going to have a fellow on here in the future that he's a guide on one of these lakes, and we fish for these blue catfish. And you put out 5 or 6 rods at a time. And he says, you watch the tip of the rod. We're trolling. We're trolling with, I forget what we used, some kind of bait fish. And all of a sudden, he says, son, when a fish strikes that rod, the tip will go into the water violently.
Yeah.
So you're sitting there in the boat watching the rod, and it's just from the waves that the tip's moving. But he's not kidding, boy. Once that rod makes a point toward the water, and you may hook anything from 20 to 60 pounds.
That's a serious fish.
That is a serious fish, I'll tell you, and it's a lot of fun. So we're glad South Carolina's underwriter. You know, I told everybody that I'm wearing clean socks tonight. We have such a special guest.
I don't think that was necessary.
Oh, absolutely it was. I'll tell you, each year we go to the National Conservation Training Center, and I've never met anyone that wasn't the greatest, and Jim Willis falls into that category. I mean, always make our visit over there. We always feel welcome.
It's a great center, and I'll be honest, we look forward to your visit every year. It's and sometimes we get you more than once, but for certain we're always excited to have you there for open house, which is kind of our way to give back to the local community is our open house, and it's good to get some wildlife education in as part of that open house.
Well, it's a good time. And, we were always blessed with nice weather, and I'll tell you what, the trip over through, Interstate 68 across Maryland, that time of the year, it's just breathtaking.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty.
Oh, my Lord. The first time I went across there, I just couldn't, man, I said, this is unbelievable. But good news today, they seem they've put a cap on that well down in Louisiana.
Yeah, that is excellent news. Our portion of the work down there is looking out for the wildlife, and when the oil just keeps coming, it's really hard to keep after that job. And although we've certainly had very dedicated people down there for a very long time, but it really is good news to have that capped. And so hopefully at this point there may be an end in sight. It'll still be a long time, but you got to start somewhere, and it's good to have it capped.
When we were talking, it doesn't seem that long, but almost a month ago when I was in Shepherdstown, What was your, when you first got down there, I want you to tell, if you don't mind your this audience, what was, in, basically, you guys had rooms that, you said you didn't even have a desk. And what was your first of all, what was your responsibility when you went down to Louisiana? And
yeah, well, essentially the National Conservation Training Center is the training staff for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and a good portion of the wildlife recovery operations that are part of the oil spill are being conducted by Fish and Wildlife U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service professionals. We've got a lot of state partners there with us too, but the bottom line is there's a lot of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service folks down in the Gulf working every day to recover wildlife and assess the damage that's being done to the beaches and to the habitat. And there was a need for training for those folks, not so much from the wildlife perspective as from dealing with hazardous materials. So we went down there to establish, I was the first one down there, and we went down there to establish a couple of training centers, one for each of the command posts. There's a major command post in Houma, Louisiana. There's another major command post in Mobile, Alabama. And those are part of the unified command, which are, you know, you actually see them on television pretty regularly. You know, Admiral Allen, of course, is in charge of the whole unified command structure, and then there's various people underneath him, et cetera. So our job was to go down and make sure that the people that were out there on the ground doing wildlife recovery operations had, you know, the right training so that they would be safe while they were doing that recovery. And so we, you know, we went down and we started from scratch with nothing, and we, you know, rented space to establish training centers, and we established curriculum that was needed, you know, basically by doing a quick needs assessment, training needs assessment, and put this whole program together, one at each of the command centers, which is running right now, and we're up around 200 to 300 professionals trained at those facilities now.
Wow.
Conditions down there were kind of interesting. I mean, yeah, it's just, You just can't, you maybe even can't quite understand how many people working so many hours all together trying to do the right thing, you know, how busy people are. I mean, literally, pretty much everybody down there is working 15 to 16 hour days, and there's just no time to take care of the, you know, minor details. So, you know, we were having, you know, meetings in a conference room, and there'd be three chairs in there, and there'd be 15 people. And so, you know, a bunch of us would sit on the floor, and a, you know, a couple might sit on the table, and then, you know, the three most important people might get a chair, and you just hold the meeting, because, you know, it's the meeting that's important, it's the discussion that's important, and nobody cared about the chairs, and nobody had time to worry about them. So it was just that kind of a pace of operations going on down there, and just pretty exciting to see that level of commitment to essentially the wildlife of America, because the group I was working with were not involved in the spill cleanup per se. That was, you know, that's the Coast Guard and other folks. You know, the people I was working with were in the what they call the wildlife operations branch. And this is these are the professionals from the Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA and the Louisiana Wildlife and Fisheries folks, et cetera, that were committed to getting out there and being, you know, right on scene whenever a bird is discovered, and they're actually searching for birds, you know, that have gotten oil on them and need cleaning. So there was a lot of work going on there, and it was pretty enlightening and heartening to see that level of commitment and that number of professionals that were out there on the ground every day you know, looking for those birds and looking for the turtles and trying to save as many of them as we could. So that's probably a lot to say, but you know, it was a very inspiring opportunity to get down there and see that in happening.
Well, you know, every time you have a situation like this, essentially a disaster, it brings out the best in people, and really there's always a good element about it.
Yeah, like I said, it really was inspiring. And you know, probably one of the things that I thought was most inspiring was how quickly the different agencies that were responsible for wildlife bonded together and began working together. So, you know, when in Louisiana, you know, there was U.S. Fish and Wildlife folks going out in state, you know, Department of Wildlife and Fishery boats and vice versa. And, you know, it just didn't matter who was in charge. You know, we were all out there, you know, searching for, you know, damaged birds, injured birds that we could bring back and get rehabilitated. The other groups that were very impressive to watch, there were two groups down there doing bird rescue. The Tri-State Bird, let me get their name right here, Tri-State Bird Rescue and Research and International Bird Rescue and Research Center. Those two groups were the ones actually, they're professionals, and they go all over the world at oil spills and do the cleanup, and they were just fantastic. You know, what they would set up, I mean, I'll give you one example of one that I personally observed. Boy. They had a triage center in Houma, or actually at Grand Isle, which is on the coast of Louisiana, south of Houma. They had a triage center. The boats would go out. They'd find these birds. They'd bring them to the triage center, which looked like a little tractor trailer, just parked there at the dock. So as soon as the boat got back to the dock, they had a process where they were going through to get those birds cleaned up a little bit and stabilized. And then, you know, after a couple hours of stabilization, they'd actually put them in another boat, and they had a 40-minute boat ride over to the major bird rehab center where they would stay for days until they were completely stabilized and ready to be shipped off to Texas or Florida, you know, where they would be, you know, rehabilitated into a new area that didn't have oil in it. So it was really, really exciting to watch people operate and work together.
Well, and people don't understand, a lot of people don't understand that these birds can literally, well, any animal can die of just stress.
Oh, yeah, yes. And they had to be very careful about that. And I know, you know, they just really were very careful with the birds. You know, if they were transporting them in a car, you know, they couldn't have the air conditioning too cold. It had to be, you know, just slightly above the ambient temperature or slightly below the ambient temperature that was outside, because it was very hot down there, you know, when I was down there. And so there were lots of things that they had to take into account. You know, the least stressful way to capture them, the least stressful way to transport them, the least stressful way to clean them. I mean, yeah, these were all professionals, and they were trained to do this, so It was a good operation and very well done.
We see lots of pelicans in the TV film footage and so forth. That those are probably the easiest for them to rescue.
Yeah, I think, you know, the pelicans are just big birds, and so they're real obvious. They're the easiest to find, and they're relatively easy to capture. So there are a lot of pelicans being captured, and you know, I think also just from their style of fishing, they're likely to get oiled, you know, because they're skimming the surface and they're, you know, diving into it, you know, when they see something that looks edible. So the bottom line is there are a lot of a high number of pelicans that are that are getting injured and also that are getting oiled and being captured and then rehabilitated. So if you probably, if you watch the news, you probably see that, you know, most of the shipments are, have a very high percentage of pelicans.
Yeah, so I noticed that. And it's too bad because some of the birds that are a little bit more wary or a little trickier to get under control, let's say, we'll put it that way. It makes it tougher for these wildlife rehabilitators and also for the species in its own way.
Yeah, and you know, of course, we're all very concerned that, you know, it's easy to see the big birds, but, you know, there's small birds that,
right,
you know, can get oil on them and go hide in the marsh and we'll never see them.
That's the sad part.
Yeah, that's the sad part. So we won't know the total damage from this spill for years, but, you know, there are damage assessment teams, natural resource damage assessment teams that are out there right now trying to get a baseline so that, you know, hopefully we'll be able to tell the real damage. And then of course the goal is to strive to bring the Gulf back to where it was before this happened.
Yeah, that's it. We're with Jim Willis of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We're going to take a short break. We have some PSAs. We'll be back in just a few moments. You're listening to Blog Talk Radio, and this is Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
There are some visitors you'd just rather not see. Like your obnoxious brother-in-law, Louie.
Hey, everybody, we're here. Good to see you. When do we eat?
But then there are some visitors you just can't get enough of. To make your farm or ranch a more attractive place for the visitors you actually want to see, contact your local Natural Resources Conservation Service office. They can help you build the habitat wildlife loves. But as for Louie, try disconnecting the doorbell. This message brought to you by USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service and this radio station.
We're Rascal Flats. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
Take me fishing because I miss my boy.
Rediscover the joy of boating and fishing. Get information and get going at takemefishing.org.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny! Playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters?
Ish. Bobcat, heavy. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean? Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson. You're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight's guest, Jim Willis of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we've been discussing a little bit about the oil spill. Of course, the good news today, they capped that sucker, so hopefully it's all, well, I won't say it's downhill from here, but they can start the cleanup. We want to remind everyone that we are underwritten by Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina, Lake Marion and Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes. They cover 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline. And, hey, if you want to go to a super place to go fishing, I'm going to tell you right now, that's the place. Here's their number, 1-800-227-8510, or their website, www.santeecoopercountry.org. They'll fix you right up if your next fishing trip down to South Carolina. Also, a big thank you to We Want You Cottages up in western New York, Lake Chautauqua, and their website, wewantyou.com, and their exciting new feature on their website called iKids Fishing, where youngsters from all across the country, those young anglers, can compare their big catch, that big whopper, with other youngsters that have downloaded their photos from the recent fishing expeditions. That's at We Want You Cottages at wewantyou.com. Also, McGregor Mountain Lodge in scenic Estes Park, Colorado, right on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. That website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com. And also a big thank you to the Bass Pro Shops, especially the one in Clarksville, Indiana, for being an underwriter for our program, or the Tracker Marine Boating Center. So give Dan White a call, 812-218-5369. Or if you have an opportunity, check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. Tells all about our wildlife rescue work that we do, also our wildlife educational programs, the books that we have out, and that's at LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. Tonight's guest, a gentleman I've known for many, many years from our trip over to Shepherdstown for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at the National Conservation Training Center. That's a lot of syllables. Jim Willis is with us tonight. How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing great.
I know.
And it is a lot. It is a lot of syllables.
It is. I figured before this night was over, between your resume and the National Conservation Training Center, I thought, oh, I'll be kicking words, but so far so good.
Yeah, we just call it NCTC when we're local. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I have to ask you, when you first got down there, could you smell oil right away? That's one of my first questions.
No, I'll be honest. I mean, most of my time was in the command centers, and
mm-hmm.
both of the command centers are probably 20 to 30 miles from the shoreline.
Oh. Okay.
And so you really can't, you don't get any flavor at all of the oil or the beaches or any of that at the command centers. Fortunately, and I got a chance to spend time at both command centers, and in each case I got a half a day to actually get down to the shore. And in Louisiana, there was oil in some places on the marshes, but you couldn't smell it, and driving along in a car, you really couldn't see it. And although we just didn't have time to get out in a boat, so we really didn't see the oil. On the other hand, in Mobile, I got down to the beach. You know, the Mobile Command Center is dealing with a different set of problems than Louisiana. Louisiana has a lot of marshes, and the barrier islands are actually marshes more so than beaches. So the oil kind of creeps around, and it gets around back in there and starts doing damage to the different habitat. And so they're working with booms and stuff to try and keep it out of there. Up on the northern coast, you know, near Mobile, Alabama, and, you know, the western Florida peninsula out there, and, you know, the coast of Alabama and the coast of Mississippi, a lot of that is a sandy barrier islands. You know, I'm from North Carolina, so I compare it to, you know, kind of like Cape Hatteras, et cetera, but with a few more buildings on it. And that area, you know, what I saw when I was there, and, of course, it all depends on which way the wind's blowing on any given day, but when I was there, there was no oil on the beach at all. And I walked down probably a mile or so beach there at Bon Secours National Wildlife Refuge. But what there was, when I was there, were all of these big monster dump trucks running up and down the beach, because they had these, clam digger, I don't know what you call them, drag lines. I think we call in North Carolina, we call them drag lines. But there's these big buckets on the end of an arm with tractor treads or, caterpillar-type treads. They were down right at the shore's edge, and they had the bucket out into the surf digging up sand with oil on it.
Huh.
And they were taking those buckets of oil, of oiled sand, and they were putting them on, a plastic liner on the beach. And then they had another bucket, another piece of equipment there that was taking that sand and putting it in the dump trucks. And then the dump trucks were taking it up to, further inland where they were dumping it in a central location. And then from that, they were dumping it into these big dump trucks that were designed to go on the interstate highways.
Mm-hmm.
And they were trucking it out of there. But the bottom line is, even then, unless you got close to the pile where they were actually dumping this stuff, you couldn't smell the oil. But that's what was going on the particular day that I was down at the beach there in Bon Secours National Wildlife Refuge.
Do you think? Go ahead.
Yeah.
Do you think that some of the aspects of this disaster is kind of blown out of proportion through television and so forth?
Well, there's certainly been a little bit of sensationalism from the standpoint of, what reporters can see or can't see, and whether there's a bunch of conspiracy theories running around and all of this thing, but. I'll be honest, that's probably just noise.
Mm-hmm.
What's really the issue is the absolute total huge amount of oil that's been pumped into the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
And there's no getting around that. That is a lot of oil and a lot of dispersants. And we're going to be dealing with that for a very long time. And it's going, and it has killed and will kill an amazing amount of wildlife, is my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can't, I don't think we can overstate the impact on wildlife of this amount of oil. And I know, there's been a lot of efforts to stop this, and, thankfully, as of today, it looks like they may have finally stopped it. But in the meantime, an incredible amount of oil has just moved into the environment. And because of the dispersant, it's kind of throughout the water column is my understanding of the entire Gulf of Mexico. So it's just a bad situation. And that situation I don't think can be overstated.
You had said when we were in Shepherdstown that the oil company that responsible, that owned the well,
mm-hmm.
they've been right up front, and when funds are needed, they're very forthcoming.
They, certainly for wildlife operations,
mm-hmm.
they've been writing the checks, as things are needed. And so and I know that there are people, and I was watching someone on television today that said, that they had applied for money from BP and hadn't gotten it, and that, they were turning off the electricity in some of the homes in town because people didn't have any money for their livelihood. And
right.
And I can't speak to those issues,
mm-hmm.
But from an operational standpoint, for the money that BP has been requested to provide for wildlife operations, they've certainly been responsive. They're like any other big company. Sometimes a little bit of red tape gets in the way, but in general, in my opinion, considering the magnitude of the disaster and the challenges that are going on, in my opinion, they have been responsive to the needs of the wildlife staff. We have, as of yesterday, we had like 90 teams operating out of Houma, Louisiana. 90 teams out
wow.
there looking for wildlife. and we had 40 operating out of Mobile. Louisiana has more teams for a couple of reasons. One is they started earlier. Two is it appears they have gotten more of the oil. And three is the actual structure of their coastline makes it harder to really capture all the wildlife. So you got more teams there. But the bottom line is all of those teams are out there. They're out there every day. The team members are being paid. You know, their salaries are being paid through BP and the equipment and all of that stuff. I mean, it's all, you know, it's all being billed back through BP. So, again, I think they've been forthcoming, and they seem to have been doing a fairly good job in that area.
I think the most, and I wasn't really aware of this until our talk tonight, but I think the most amazing thing about this is how you say basically these training centers had to be created from scratch.
Yeah.
These wildlife rescuers had to go down there and basically put together their facilities while this disaster was developing. I think it's amazing.
Well, it is, and it's pretty amazing to watch. And you know, but we've had amazing cooperation from the local folks. I mean, when you go in and tell them you're there to help the wildlife, I mean, they just open doors. And you know, I'll give you one example for the Mobile area. The wildlife branch is actually across the bay from the Unified Command, and it's in a community called Daphne, Alabama. And we needed a classroom, and we needed one for a long time, and it had to have certain characteristics. We found that classroom at a state park, and it's called the Five River State Park. And they opened their doors, and they gave us, you know, one of their classrooms indefinitely. I mean, and, you know, they just been perfect for us and really, really helped us. And, you know, that's the state of Alabama, you know, providing and helping, you know, with the wildlife recovery operations. And they were just wonderful. And, you know, so, again, we got that kind of cooperation, and when the locals are helping you like that, it just makes your life a lot easier.
Oh, I mean, it has. There's going to be a million stories come out of this. I'm sure right now in production there's a million documentaries that are being produced just about the rescue operation with the wildlife and some of the things that you talked about tonight. This is going to be a major part of our life for a long time.
I think it is. I mean, we certainly talked about the Exxon Valdez for a very long time, and that incident made major changes in U.S. policy, and I think, you know, this is so much bigger that it's going to change a lot of U.S. policy, and it's going to be a major recovery effort in the Gulf for a very long time.
I imagine there's some engineer somewhere, some scientist, that if they design and develop a thing, some type of machine, submarine that can go down and put a cap on one of those things within a few hours, every oil company will have to have one.
That's a good thought. And you know, we're straying out of my wildlife expertise, but let me give you my personal opinion.
Sure.
You know, somebody explained it to me this way, and I thought it was pretty interesting. They said, you know, the problem with this particular situation is, you know, we've got a fire, and we've had to go invent a fire truck.
Yeah.
You know, we had to come up with wheels, we had to come up with hose, we had to, you know, just go invent a fire truck while the fire was burning. They said, you know, in reality, we needed the fire truck at the beginning, and like you said, you know, it's probably going to be some submarine with a blowout preventer on the front of it.
Yeah.
You know, that will be the backup to the blowout preventer that already didn't work on the well.
So there was actually you may not even be. Is there actually something that's required like that on these type of deals or?
Well, the well itself, I mean, you know, that the reason we had the problem is the blowout preventer that was on the well actually malfunctioned. I mean, every well has been required to have one of these for a while, and
okay.
this one, this one malfunctioned, otherwise we wouldn't have had this problem.
Right.
And the bottom line is that's one level of backup, but you know, when that failed, there was nothing else. And like you said, a submarine with something on the bow of it that allows you to just go down there and do this all in one step in a couple of hours is probably somewhere in the future of major oil companies that want to drill in deep water.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, we're just pre-inventing here, but
oh, yeah,
you know, like I said, there's some scientists out there looking at this problem. I mean, well, a prime example is that 160-ton piece of equipment that they just dropped down on 160,000 pounds, I'm sorry, a piece of equipment that they just dropped down to cap it this time. I mean, even if that piece of equipment had existed, you know, 3 months ago,
mm-hmm.
This would have been a much more bearable oil spill. But somebody had to invent it and build it.
Yeah, that's the whole problem. So it really
yeah.
did something pretty unbelievable, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you were talking about having to put together these schools. You've had a little bit of experience doing this. In fact, I've read that in 2006 you led an international assistance team to the Republic of Georgia.
I did.
To help them design a training center for their natural resource professionals.
Yeah, there was. I've been very fortunate, and training is kind of my profession, and so. Because I've had done this for a lot of years, I get called on once in a while to do something pretty unique. And the Republic of Georgia has, they're a relatively new country, and they are very, very concerned about their natural resources. And, you know, they also recognize that the U.S. has been conserving natural resources for over 100 years. The first National Wildlife Refuge was established in 1903, Pelican Island down in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than try and reinvent the wheel, Republic of Georgia, they're smart enough, and they got some good folks there that said, you know, we can learn from the Americans, and so they ask us to come over and help them design a training center and help them design a curriculum for their natural resource professionals. So I was part of a two-man team, and my part of it was actually to help them design a training center. So I went over and helped them do that. And then it turned out, actually, we were supposed to be two-man teams, and it turned out only one of each team showed up. So I actually partnered up with the guy doing the curriculum. And between the two of us, we did we gave them a design for a training center, and we gave them five different curricula for the most important things we felt like they needed to teach their folks that were running their national parks. And it was an exciting couple of weeks and busy, as you can imagine, to do all of that in 2 weeks.
Oh,
but we got it done, and we left them with a good blueprint. And there have been follow up teams that have gone over and taught some of those subjects. So it's working out well for them as a country.
So do they have a little NCTC over there now?
Well, it's kind of interesting. They have. What I designed for them is a single classroom in their headquarters building.
I see.
And it's still not been built.
Oh.
But, you know, that's the way things work in developing countries.
Absolutely.
But we've had at least two additional excursions over there, and we've actually taught the curricula that we designed. We just had to do it in conference rooms instead of that new training center. I don't know if it will ever be built. They like the idea, they like the layout and everything else, but you know, they have limited resources, and so they're making do with conference rooms in a lot of cases.
We talked earlier that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has to be one of the greatest places to work to be employed by. In fact, the SC3 I really thought was kind of a recruiting for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because the youngsters from this day and age, they don't go out like we did when we were kids.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, it is a great outfit. I've worked in a couple of different agencies over the years, and I've never worked at a better place with more dedicated employees. You know, one of the things that's kind of interesting about the Fish and Wildlife Service is, you know, people get into this work because they care about the wildlife of America, the fish and the wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, they are just so dedicated that, you know, they don't care how long it takes. They don't care what hours it takes. They just get out there and do what they can to improve the habitat. You know, they work on endangered species issues. They're just out there making a difference every day for the Fish and Wildlife of America. And we're so fortunate as a country that we have protected these resources. I mean, I had that trip over to Republic of Georgia, and they have some spectacular parks. What is missing in a lot of those parks are wildlife. Most of the big wildlife has been hunted to extinction, and so they've got a few around, and you know they have the right idea, and with luck, they may be able to bring things back. But the bottom line is, you know, in America, we've said this is important to us as a culture, and we've been protecting these things for a long time. Yes, we killed most of the bison, but, you know, we finally understand, and we're bringing back the bison. And things like that. So, yeah, it's great agency to be part of, and I'm proud to go to work every day. It's just a neat group to work with.
Oh, they are. Is there one moment, Jim, in your career, which is far from over, that really stands out that say, hey, this is just too cool?
Well, I've had two of those. One of them was my first week with the Fish and Wildlife Service. I had the opportunity to actually pet a cheetah.
Wow.
And this was the cheetah Savannah from the Miami Zoo.
Uh-huh.
She was up at the NC. She actually stayed at the NCTC, the National Conservation Training Center.
Yep.
And she stayed there overnight and was part of our open house that year,
uh-huh,
which was my first year there.
Uh-huh.
And I got, you know, and... you know, she was so busy. The kids, the school kids, just loved her so much. She was so busy all day that I didn't even get a chance to see her. So I waited until after we were basically technically closed and the people had started to wander away, and I just, you know, went into the classroom where she was. And the trainers and her were just kind of sitting there, and they said, you know, we want to wait until all the kids and the parents and everything have kind of cleared out a little bit before we walk her out, because we don't want her to get excited and all of that kind of stuff. So basically,
right,
you know, for a half an hour, I was sitting in a classroom with a cheetah, and when I got done with that, I went, wow. Yeah, I said, wow, this is my new job, and it just doesn't get any better. And, you know, probably the second time that it struck me how great this organization was
uh-huh,
down in Houma, Louisiana, when I first got to see the Fish and Wildlife Service in operation helping out with this oil spill. And that was... That was very exciting too.
Well, Jim, I want to tell you I appreciate it so much for you agreeing to be on tonight. This has been quite a thrill for I know myself and our many listeners from, believe it or not, from around the world. And I'll bend your ear in the future. I'd like to have you come back and chat with us again if you don't mind.
Okay. Well, it was a pleasure, Larry, and we appreciate all that you're doing for the wildlife of America too. I know you do it firsthand a lot more than I do. I train the people that do it, but you actually do a lot of it yourself.
Well,
you and Cheryl.
We love NCTC, and we'll see you in October. We want to remind everybody that next week on the show, Rupert from Survivor is going to be on. That should be an interesting hour. And this is Larry Batson. Have a great week, everybody, and we'll be back next Thursday, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.